I'm here to introduce Tony Peterle from WorldCast Systems. Tony Peterle grew up in Central Ohio, began picking things apart at an early age to find out how they worked. Fortunately for his parents' sanity, he quickly learned how to put them back together. He graduated from the College of Worcester in 1981. He has been involved in radio broadcasting continuously since high school, working in Ohio, Kansas, Hawaii, and Washington State, both on-air and engineering positions. Tony's held chief engineering positions in Honolulu, Kansas City, and Wichita. After attaining his commercial pilot's license, Tony spent several years as a traffic reporter in Kansas City, Honolulu, and Seattle before receiving CSRE certification from the SBE in 2005. Shortly thereafter, he came to work for WorldCast Systems, where he now manages sales and support for all of the Americas. He enjoys helping customers solve problems, traveling, and contributing to the design of new products, and seeing familiar faces at NAB and SBE events. Let's welcome Tony Peterle.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Everybody here all right? Good. Appreciate the opportunity to be here and address the Broadcasters Clinic here in Wisconsin. Our topic today is IP audio, audio delivery over IP, specifically the internet, being able to deliver high quality, reliable broadcast audio over public internet connections. It's kind of a scary topic, and it's one that's been much discussed. So we're going to first talk about what was and maybe what's not so easy to find anymore, and that's our old backbones, the old reliable synchronous technologies, T1 and ISDN. Now, it's been a while since I've ordered an ISDN circuit myself, but I talk to engineers all the time that are having increasing difficulties. Anybody have problems ordering ISDN lately? Yeah. Anybody have problems paying for ISDN lately? Likewise, T1. I just got a phone call from an engineer in New York City, called his provider and could not find anybody that knew what ISDN was. They offered him a T1 PRI, which he could then adapt to ISDN, but these technologies and the knowledge base, much as the knowledge base of tube transmitter guys is starting to retire, the knowledge of telco providers and the people inside the telco providers that understand what a synchronous circuit is, what a T1 is, how to fix it, how to install it, and what we need in terms of service from a broadcast perspective. I had one guy that was operating on a T1 link. Link went down on a Friday afternoon. He called the telco provider and they said, yep, it's down. We'll send somebody out first thing Monday morning. So the level of service that we're able to get on these synchronous links is sometimes not what we need for the broadcast industry. So we've seen a big migration from synchronized circuits to IP for delivering audio. And that's a trend that is accelerating and we see is going to continue for the foreseeable future. A lot of reasons to migrate to IP. I mean, there's just the efficiency of the network. The fact that using multiple unicast or multicast technologies, if your network supports it, you can distribute audio to a large number of destinations with very little effort. It doesn't require each link doesn't require a separate path. It doesn't require a separate service. Internet is available. It's available everywhere. It's in the air. We can pick up internet from 3G and 4G services in many rural unincorporated areas. We can get DSL connections. We can get cable. We can even use microwave IPs when there is no other option. The internet, I don't know if I would use the term simple, but network technology and IP routing and things like that are things that broadcast engineers are becoming more and more familiar with. So it's not as hard for us to debug an IP connection as it may have been in the past. So the migration is going to happen despite the advantages of these synchronous links. Of course, the synchronous links offered us a reliability, you know, point-to-point delivery, guaranteed data and error rates, and a very low latency, very low delay between the sending of the audio and the delivery of the audio at the destination. And that latency remained fixed, which is critical for translator applications and a lot of network things because you're hitting timings for IDs at the top of the hour, and so the playout of the audio has to stay very consistent, the playout timing of the audio. So the IP era has arrived, and it's here to stay. Now, The quick mention of the difference between unicast and multicast, for those that maybe are a little bit new to this whole IP world and delivering audio over IP. Unicast is a delivery of an audio stream from one point to another point. In other words, you're sending an audio stream from this IP address to the destination IP address. There is a version called multiple unicast, where one transmit unit can send audio streams to several IP destinations, but each of those is a fixed discrete link. So it's like a series of individual connections. So that's what we call multiple unicast. So you have a studio that can be sending one or multiple streams into the cloud to their intended destinations. Multicasting is a whole lot more efficient. Multicasting is a way for the IP network itself to duplicate the streams. So multicasting is a specific protocol. There are specific IP addresses that are designated as multicast IP addresses. And on a network that supports multicasting, you can send one audio stream out to a given multicast IP address, and then each receiver in the cloud that is configured to receive packets destined for that multicast IP address is going to get it. So the difference between multicast, there are two main differences between multicast and multiple unicast. Multicasting, the packets, the streams are replicated in the cloud. So from the source into the IP connection, you are only sending one stream. So your bandwidth requirements for multicasting on the send end are extremely low. It's just a single stream. All the replication happens in the cloud. So each of the individual streams gets its each of the individual receive points. Now, if you're doing multiple unicast, that is going to require a bigger pipe at the send end, because each of those individual streams that you're sending those individual destinations is its own discrete thing, and it's going to require bandwidth, upload bandwidth at the send end. So that's the biggest difference, or one of the biggest differences between multicast and multiple unicast, is the bandwidth requirement at the send end. The bandwidth requirement at the receive end doesn't change. The other big difference is that you need a specific network architecture to support multicast. So if you have your own internal WAN, if you have a VPN connection, there are IT people who are, you know, many, many layers above my knowledge of the subject that will have to set that up. It requires a specific set of switches and a specific set of programs and details to support the multicast protocol on the network. So multicast and the public internet do not mix. You cannot do multicasting over public internet unless you establish a structure inside the public internet like a WAN or a VPN connection, then you might be able to achieve multicasting. But generally, multicast and public internet connections don't work. You can also, in terms of delivering audio over IP and doing it in a reliable fashion, you can also use a managed IP network. Now, a managed IP network would be the type of network that could support multicasting. It also, managed IP network allows you to prioritize traffic. We see this sometimes even in internal studio networks where they have their own private IP link between the studio and the transmitter site. They're sending audio out to the site, and then somebody else says, oh, well, gosh, I can also access the embedded website of my audio processor out there. Or I can hook up the Ethernet port of my transmitter and get all my information from my transmitter and do my monitoring and stuff on that same IP link. And then they start wondering why their audio is getting interrupted. They're having, you know, packet loss and dropouts on the audio. Well, it's because they haven't done any quality of service or traffic management configuration on their network. So even internally, sometimes you only have a limited amount of bandwidth between studio and transmitter, and using a managed network with managed switches allows you to put what they call quality of service, QoS, standards in place that prioritize the audio traffic so that the other traffic doesn't interrupt it or cause you any problems. There are also ways that you could send audio over OpenIP using forward error correction. That achieves redundancy up to a certain degree. The drawbacks to forward error correction is that it eats up even more bandwidth. Because you're replicating packets, you're repeating packets, resending packets. It also adds significantly to the delay that's required in the audio link so that your audio playout isn't going to happen until many hundreds of milliseconds after the audio is sent, which sometimes is a significant factor. Another thing you can do in a managed network is called MPLS. And some internet service providers can even set you up with an MPLS network through the public internet. MPLS stands for Multi-Protocol Label Switching, and it's essentially a kind of a looser version of a quality of service type designation, where you could prioritize packets with certain labels on them so that those packets are routed and switched in a faster manner. Unmanaged networks don't do any of that stuff. They just put the infrastructure out there and say, have at it, use at your own risk, caveat emptor, and all the other disclaimers that they put in the little fine print at the bottom of your internet service provider contracts. Unmanaged IP networks, and this includes both the public internet and any internal network that isn't managed, the switches and the routers and everything in that network will simply apply a best effort. They'll try and get the packets to where they're supposed to be in a fairly timely manner. If it happens, great. If it's not, no big deal. Not great when we're trying to send audio and trying to send it with a very short delay and trying to send it reliably and get no dropouts, because you lose packets, the stream gets interrupted, you get large swings in what we call the jitter performance, which is the timing of the packets as they arrive at the destination. Packets arrive out of order, so your delay buffer has to move around. And of course, you can lose a loss of connection. You actually lose the network connection completely. So sometimes you'll have a router or switch somewhere in that unmanaged IP network that gets hung up. You get a bunch of packets that pile up like traffic on the freeway. If the router gets reset, those packets may get sent onto their destination. They may not. It's a horrible situation. It's an ugly, ugly concept. It's an ugly structure when you consider trying to transmit broadcast quality audio over that kind of a connection. So we need a very pragmatic solution to make this done. To understand the solution and to understand how we can deliver broadcast quality audio over public internet connections, we need to understand a little bit more about how this audio is delivered. What happens to audio? What's different about sending it over a T1 link as opposed to sending it over an IP link? Biggest difference is that when we're sending over IP, the audio is encapsulated. So our audio samples are taken and they're divided up into little tiny chunks. Each one of those chunks is assigned to an IP packet, and those packets individually go off into the ether and make their way through the network to get to their destination. Each packet, in order for it to get to where it's going, has to have what's called a header. And the header of the packet contains information about the source IP, the destination IP, what type of data is in the packet. The header size is constant, so all of the information of the data and everything for the audio itself is contained in what we call the protocol data unit. Now, you can vary the size of the packets. You can send more or less audio with each packet, but the size of the headers remains constant. So it's pretty easy to see. Here's a quick look at packet construction. You've got the audio content, your RTP header, then a UDP header, then an IP header, and then an Ethernet header. So all of that stuff is added to the audio data, and then the CRC for error control as well. So you're taking up, depending on the size of the audio content, the chunk of audio that you've decided to include in each packet, depending on the size of that, the packet could be, four times that size. There's 80% of the packet is out of your control in terms of what's included in there. It's all header information. And that has a big effect on how much bandwidth you're going to need to get the audio through. We'll take we'll choose this middle protocol here. So if your audio data rate is 256 kilobits a second, now that's what you need for our 16-bit enhanced haptics lossless algorithm to get 15 kilohertz stereo. You need 256 kilobits a second. That's the audio. Now, if you choose a small packet size, like 256 bytes, your IP packet size is going to be 322, 125 packets a second, 8 millisecond delay. Your actual IP data rate that you need to get that audio through is 322 kilobits a second. If you choose a larger audio packet size, say 1280 bytes, You follow that through, you're only using 269, so you've saved yourself 50 kilobits a second just by choosing a larger packet size. So that's something you've got to keep in mind as you plan out your network and your uplinks and downlinks, because some of these DSL connections, the cheaper DSL connections, you're only getting, you know, 300, maybe 500 kilobits a second upload speed. So keeping your packet size larger keeps your bandwidth requirements down. The drawback is if you lose a packet, that's a much bigger chunk of audio you've lost. If you lose an audio packet and it's only, you know, 256 bytes, that's a less significant loss of audio. All right, so a characteristic of the packet switch networks, every packet can theoretically take any route through the cloud, through the network, to get from point A to point B. Now, it's not tremendously common. If you establish a stream from one IP address to another and the packets start going, chances are 99.5% that all or most all of those packets are going to follow the exact same route from router to router, from switch to switch. But it doesn't have to be that way. You know, a network by its nature is self-healing. It's there are many different ways to get from your source to your destination. So even though the network will apply a best effort approach to try and get you the best path, the shortest path, the most direct path from source to destination, it doesn't necessarily happen every time. If packets are taking different routes, there's a high likelihood that packets will arrive either side of their predicted ETA. They'll arrive out of order, and so they will need to be resequenced, and that's why we have to have a buffer. Whenever we're sending audio over IP, we need to have some kind of a buffer so that we can take those packets in and assemble the ones that arrive out of order and then play out the audio. How much buffer you need is going to depend on the latency of the network, the speed of the link between the source and the destination. That's going to have the biggest impact on how much buffer you need. All right, if you can't get an IP link to your transmitter site, well, you've got a couple of different options. We've had a lot of success using IP over microwave links, licensed and unlicensed. There are, you know, of course, you've got to make your path calculations to make sure that you're going to have the bandwidth that you need. You've got to consider rain fade, distance obstructions, that sort of thing. The downside is what happens if you can't get a microwave path out there for whatever reason, cost or terrain or who knows, you don't have a way to get microwave IP out to the site. Well, then we're talking about using internet connections. Broadcast audio over the internet. The internet is public. Anything public can be messy. Think public transportation, public restrooms. It's not necessarily a place that you want to touch. All right, an audio codec can host a couple of different, you know, possibilities to correct for this. Forward error correction we mentioned beforehand. You can do a lot of error correction. Increases the bandwidth that you need, significantly increases the delay, and it's not so good if you're losing bursts of packets. If you lose one or two packets here or there, forward error correction can generally patch that up. If you lose a chunk of packets, 20 or 30 in a row, forward error correction is going to have a much harder time making that happen. Another solution that's been tried is dynamic stream adaptation, which if the quality of the link starts to degrade, the sending codec automatically rolls back the audio bandwidth in order to keep the link alive, which is great. You've still got some audio going, but that audio starts to sound more and more like a telephone conversation and not your, you know, 15 kilohertz stereo or 20 kilohertz that you want to get out to your transmitter site. So our brilliant technology guys came up with a solution that we call SureStream. We're going to talk a little bit about how this works. But our targets for this technology were to allow high-quality audio transmission to have a constant fixed delay between the sending of the audio and the playout at the receive end, balance any swings of delay jitter, cope with the best effort transmission of the public internet, inject no additional latency, no significant additional latency like FEC does, no restriction on the formats of audio compression formats, so it's algorithm agnostic. flexible in terms of no restrictions on the audio settings or the IP addresses that you're using, and allows multiple levels of stream protection. So, the number of accesses, let's see. We'll just skip on past that one. So, in a nutshell, the solution that we've applied is to send redundant streams. All right, it does require more bandwidth at both send and receive ends, but it's always on redundancy. It's not a question of waiting for one link to fail or one stream to fail and then switching over to the other one. All the streams are on all the time. So it was developed for unmanaged networks, and you send two streams out into the cloud, they show up at the receive end, there's some packets missing from this stream, or packets missing from that stream, whatever packets are missing are filled in from the other component stream, the other contributing stream. Two streams would be the minimum. You can go more. If you've got the bandwidth to go more, you can send three streams or four streams, each one increasing the reliability. So we generate the redundant IP streams. Key thing is that they've got to have identical RTP content in the headers. That way, when the packets arrive at the receiver knows that, you know, which packets match from each stream. We do some stream shaping by the encoder engine, deliver the streams to the network, and then we've got a special receiver combiner ART algorithm on the decoder that resequences the packets and plays them out. The Mac daddy of SureStream is to do SureStream on dual network ports. Most of the equipment that we have that supports SureStream, we have some single port that does it, which protects you against packet loss. But if you run the boxes that have two Ethernet ports, you can actually send component streams, you can send multiple component streams out of each Ethernet port. So literally the way we have a lot of people installing these is they have two separate internet service providers, one cable, one DSL, or maybe one microwave link and one DSL connection. We even have customers that are doing some one leg on DSL and the other leg on satellite. They've got to adjust their buffer a little bit to compensate for the bounce up to the bird and back because there's some significant delay there. But that way, not only are you protected against packet loss, you're also protected against loss of connection events. You can literally run the whole thing on completely separate networks, separate routers. Even if your internet service provider crashes, you've still got multiple streams up and running and your audio is still getting from source to destination. So we had a demo set up at IBC last month with one of our new audio over IP cards, and literally you could sit there with the headphones on and pull a network cable out of the audio over IP card, pull one of the two network cables, and then plug it back in and then pull the other one and hear nothing except the audio. No glitches, no dropouts. We've been dealing with the SureStream and selling the SureStream in the U.S. now for about a year. We've got 100 some odd units in place, and actually one of our success stories is right here in the audience, Dan Hoag, waving there. Dan's a gentleman out of Grand Rapids, Michigan, who had had an issue. Oh, Minnesota, I'm sorry. Your name tag said Grand Rapids. All right.
We get FedEx deliveries.
M-I-M-N, you know, that's some. At least it's not ME. Anyway, Dan was a broadcaster who had an issue. He needed a studio-to-studio link between the KAXE and KBXE sites, and they also needed a studio-to-transmitter link for one of those sites. So he has acquired four consumer-grade ADSL connections at a total cost of about $240 a month. And set it up. He's got a solar system. Are you still running a 300 millisecond buffer?
Yep. Between the two studios, correct.
All right. So 300 millisecond open public internet connections. That's a little bit of a description of how he set it up. You've got the bidirectional link going between the two studios, and then in addition, we've got the another link also using SureStream over an IP multi-hop IP microwave link out to one of his transmitter sites. I'll if you care to talk to Dan about his experiences, my understanding is they've been quite positive.
Yeah, they are good.
So that's the goal. I mean, we wanted to be able to send high quality, reliable audio over public internet connections and not have to worry about it, not have to worry about dropouts, not have to worry about, you know, huge amounts of delay. But Dan is one of our commercial success stories. There's one of his quotes there, you know, what was conventionally assumed as impossible has now become possible. So we can deliver high-quality broadcast audio over open public internet. We have also done a lot of testing with other groups. Of course, we're a global company. We're based in Bordeaux, France. Our codec division that does all this wonderful whiz-bang stuff is in Belfast, Ireland. And we sell and install and have solutions operating all over the world. Some of the other success stories and things that we did. This is an early test. This is back from 2011, actually. July of 2011, one of our first tests with a customer. Was sending out the SureStream, and we can see we had four component streams on this one, and we let it run for 12 hours, and we had, well, there's 13 losses of connections there, 261 losses of connections there, drop packets 7,000 with 8 loss of connection events, 7,000 drop packets there, SureStream recovered them all. Went on and continued that test for another 6 days with a similar success. And then about a year ago, we set up a link between Belfast and Miami. We said, let's really ring this thing out. So we set up a pair of our Oslo codecs in Belfast and Miami. We ordered, again, the cheapest, specifically called the providers and said, I want the crappiest DSL connection you got. Whatever's the worst bottom feeder, you know, lowest priority, you know, and we were a business, so we had to get business class, but it's pretty poor business class. I think we're spending about $40 a month for each of our links in Miami, so it is the lowest of the low in terms of the quality of service. And the first stretch that we ran with the Oslos, we ended up with a payload of about 40 million packets. So, and you can see that from the bottom line here, it's 125 million packets delivered, out of which 81 million packets were duplicate. That was the extra information that we didn't end up using. So the total payload was about 43 million packets. We lost 35. Now run the numbers on that, and I think that equates to about 7 nines reliability on open public internet connections. And that's something that you can't even get sometimes. If you order a T1, they won't guarantee you 7 nines of reliability. So then we flipped it over. We took that Belfast to Miami link and we put it on our less expensive, the Horizon Next Gen, the 1U codecs, also with dual network ports. They also run SureStream. We reset the statistics most recently in mid-September after the IBC show in Amsterdam. I grabbed this screenshot Friday when I found out I was coming up to do this presentation. And I was putting the last finishing touches on the PowerPoint. So I grabbed this screenshot Friday. I will blow it up here. So this is only three component streams. So you can see there's drop packets, 3,000, 21,000 on that one, only 281 drop packets on that one, 116, 130, 140 loss of connection errors. And then you look at the recovered SureStream, zero drop packets, zero loss of connection. So that website, codec is online, and if you come see me during the show, we'll fire up a laptop. I can even give you the address to it, and you can check in on it yourself. It's just solid as can be. Of course, we won a number of awards for the technology. We appreciate that. And just quickly, the Horizon Next Gen, the SureStream technology is also available on the traditional 3U Oslo frame, which is a multiplexer. And then we also have our new audio over IP card, which fits in the new 1U Oslo frame that was just introduced at IBC. That's a nice way to get four audio codecs into a 1U spot. Each one of those right now is capable of sending four independent audio channels. So you can do stereo duplex or you can do simplex mono. Multiple destinations, and each of those cards contains the audio interface, the IP interface, your control systems, management, everything. They're all like independent little codecs on there. So to summarize, using this technology allows you to save money on your OPEX. If you're not spending that much money on ISDN and T1 lines anymore, you're going to make your general managers happy. No compromise on audio quality. The algorithms, we can support whatever algorithm it is that you want. Right now, we're doing just linear and the enhanced aptX algorithms. We're adding AACHE, I think, by the end of this month, and by the end of the year, we should have MPEG in there as well. If you're really bandwidth limited and you need to crunch the audio down a little more, it's a scalable, redundant, reliable, lots of redundant options, all DSP-based platforms. And one more thing before we get to the questions. When I found out, it was very last minute that I found out I was going to be able to come up here, and I really appreciated the chance to come up and address this group and talk to such a great group of engineers. And I wanted to express my gratitude in a Wisconsin-appropriate way. So I wanted to find a local expert, one who knew the customs and the habits and the language that the people up at Wisconsin speak. I was at the Orlando Ennis Conference for the SBE on Friday, and fortunately, just such an expert on Wisconsin broadcast was available, and he tried to teach me to do the Bucky. So I send regards from Mr. Fred Baumgartner, and thank you all for your time, and we've got some time for questions now.
I have a question. If you lose your two service providers, does the system have a way to alarm you that it's gone? And not just the IP connection from the modem to your unit, but does it know if it lost just the IP connection or just the data from the,
does
it email you or something? Or
yeah, the codecs all have self-monitoring systems built in. So if a link is lost, they can, have a relay contact closure or, light up an alarm light. They can send an SNMP trap. They're all SNMP compliant, so if you're using any kind of a SNMP management monitoring system, they can alert you via SNMP and can be monitored and controlled via SNMP as well. So, yeah, there's ways to tell if you've lost a link or if you've had stream issues, anything along those lines.
Are you aware of anybody doing this sort of technology for video links?
At this point, no. We have dabbled in video just in kind of an experimental stage from time to time. The bandwidth requirements are just enormous compared to sending audio. But theoretically, the technology could do exactly the same thing. I mean, if you had the pipe, you could use something very similar to SureStream to send video over open internet as well.
We're actually trying to do that over the to feed a cable head end in Yuma, Arizona. And one of the things that we found out, it worked really well up until all the kids came home and lit up on the internet right around that time. We found that the big challenge was our time to live was set too low. And as soon as we jumped the time to live from the default of 16 to 32, the link became just very reliable as long as you had enough forward error correction.
Yeah, that's great. What kind of a delay do you have? Probably it's not something you're tremendously concerned about.
I have no idea, nor do I care.
Yeah.
I mean, I want to get a video signal from Phoenix to Yuma, Arizona.
Yeah.
The cable folks are never going to have any clue that it's even 5 seconds delayed.
Right, exactly. It's been interesting watching the shift since, because it's becoming less of a concern with audio as well. And that was, we have HD radio, I think, to thank for a lot of that. It's because the stations that have converted to HD, they cannot listen to their live off-air signal anymore because it's, 7 or 8 seconds behind what's going on in the studio. So if they add another second or two in latency to get their audio out to the transmitter site to begin with, it's not a significant factor for them. Another thing, the downside to that, I can actually pass along from the presentation I did Friday in Orlando was about SNMP monitoring, and one of the stations that's using the SNMP in their facility control devices is New York City, Clear Channel. And they have their main transmitter site at the Empire State Building, backup transmitter site at 4 Times Square. They've configured their remote control devices to constantly talk to each other via SNMP across the network. So the two sites are constantly reassuring one another that things are okay. And they wrote a doomsday subroutine into their facility control scripting that said if the Empire State transmitter fails for any reason, it starts, you know, a domino series of operations that would automatically switch on the four times square transmitter. And one Friday in September, it happened. And the guy, you know, he sent me an email on Monday morning. He said, you know what, Friday afternoon, some water got into our transmitter at Empire State Building, a Z100 transmitter, and the doomsday subroutine kicked in, and 30 seconds later, we were on the air from four times square. He said, nobody at the station had a clue. Other than engineering, nobody at the station even knew what had happened. And I'm thinking to myself, well, gee, it's really great that the automatic systems worked and kicked it back in, but gosh, the station in New York City was off the air for 30 seconds on a Friday afternoon and nobody knew? I'm old school. That just seems odd to me. But, you know, they were happy with the systems and the way they work. But, yeah, it's nobody's really listening in live in real time anymore. That's for sure. Do we have any other questions? Really? I was that good at explaining it all. All right. Well, I don't have an official booth because, like I said, my participation here was last minute, but I am going to be wandering around the show for the rest of today and a little bit of tomorrow morning. Happy to talk with anybody if anybody has any questions along the way. And once again, thank you, and thanks to the Wisconsin Broadcast Association to give us this opportunity. Have a good morning.